determination. No state upon its own mere motion can lawfully get out of the Union. Then followed sterner words. I shall take care, as the Constitution itself expressly enjoins upon me, that the laws of the Union be faithfully executed in all the states. Doing this I deem to be only a simple duty on my part, and I shall perform it so far as practicable, unless my rightful masters, the American people, shall withhold the requisite means, or in some authoritative manner direct the contrary. The power confided in me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the duties and imposts. Having clarified this, he returned to the question of secession, which he considered not only unlawful but unwise. Physically speaking, we cannot separate. A husband and wife may be divorced and go out of the presence and beyond the reach of each other, but the different parts of our country cannot do this. They cannot but remain face to face, and intercourse, either amicable or hostile, must continue between them. War, too, would be unwise. Suppose you go to war, you cannot fight always, and when, after much loss on both sides and no gain on either, you cease fighting, the identical old questions as to terms of intercourse are again upon you. The issue lay as in a balance, which they could tip if they chose. In your hands, my dissatisfied fellow countrymen, and not in mine, is the momentous issue of civil war. The government will not assail you. You can have no conflict without being yourselves the aggressors. You have no oath registered in heaven to destroy the government, while I shall have the most solemn one to preserve, protect, and defend it. He then read the final paragraph, written in collaboration with Seward. I am loath to close. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break our bonds of affection. The mystic cords of memory, stretching from every battlefield and patriot grave to every living heart and hearthstone all over this broad land, will yet swell the chorus of the Union when again touched, as surely they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Chief Justice Taney, tall and cave-chested, sepulchral in his flowing robes, with the face of a galvanized corpse, one witness said, stepped forward and performed the function he had performed 8 times already for 8 other men. Extending the Bible with trembling hands, he administered the oath of office to Abraham Lincoln as 16th President of the United States, and minute guns began to thud their salutes throughout the city. Reactions to this address followed in general the preconceptions of its hearers, who detected what they sought. Extremists at opposite ends found it diabolical or too mild, while the mass of people occupying the center on both sides saw in Lincoln's words a confirmation of all that they were willing to believe. He was conciliatory or cunning, depending on the angle he was seen from. Southerners, comparing it to the inaugural delivered by Jefferson Davis in Montgomery 2 weeks before, congratulated themselves on the results. For Davis had spoken with the calmness and non-contention of a man describing an established fact, seeking neither approval nor confirmation among his enemies. Standing on the portico of the Alabama Capitol, in the heart of the slave country, he did not mention slavery, an omission he had scarcely committed in 15 years of public speaking. Nor did he waste breath on the possibility of reconciliation with the old government, remarking merely that in the event of any attempt at coercion, the suffering of millions will bear testimony to the folly and wickedness of those who tried it. He spoke, rather, of agriculture and the tariff, both in Jeffersonian terms, and closed with the calm confidence of his beginning. It is joyous in the midst of perilous times to look around upon a people united in heart, where one purpose of high resolve animates and actuates the whole, where the sacrifices to be made are not weighed in the balance against honor and right and liberty and equality. Obstacles may retard, but they cannot long prevent the progress of a movement sanctified by its justice and sustained by a virtuous people. Reverently, let us invoke the God of our fathers to guide and protect us in our efforts to perpetuate the principles which by his blessing they were able to vindicate, establish, and transmit to their posterity. With the continuance of his favor, ever gratefully acknowledged, we may hopefully look forward to success, to peace, and to prosperity. He had been chosen over such fire-eaters as Rhett and Yancey, Toombs and Howell Cobb, partly for reasons of compromise, but mainly on grounds that as a moderate he would be more attractive and less alarming to the people of the border states, still hanging back, conservative and easily shocked. Yet whatever their reasons for having chosen him, the people of the Deep South, watching him move among them, his lithe, rather boyish figure trim and erect in a suit of slate-gray homespun, believed they had chosen well. "Have you seen our president?" they asked, and the visitor heard pride in their tone. Charmed by the music of his oratory, the handsomeness of his clear-cut features, the dignity of his manner, they were thankful for the providence of history, which apparently gave every great movement the leader it deserved. Such doubts as he had, he kept to himself, or declared them only to his wife still back at Briarfield, writing to her 2 days after the inauguration, "The audience was large and brilliant. Upon my weary heart were showered smiles, plaudits, and flowers. But beyond them I saw troubles and thorns innumerable. We are without machinery, without means, and threatened by a powerful opposition. But I do not despond, and will not shrink from the task imposed upon me. As soon as I can call an hour my own, I will look for a house and write you more fully." Somehow he found both the time and the house, a plain two-story frame dwelling, and Mrs. Davis and the children came to join him. "She is as witty as he is wise," one witness said. She was a great help at the levees and the less formal at-homes, having become in their senatorial years a more accomplished political manager than her husband, who had little time for anything but the exactions of his office. The croakers had already begun their chorus, though so far they were mostly limited to disappointed office seekers. Arriving, Mrs. Davis had found him careworn, but when she expressed her concern, Davis told her plainly, "If we succeed, we shall hear nothing of these malcontents. If we do not, then I shall be held accountable by friends as well as foes. I will do my best." Rising early, he worked at home until breakfast, then went to his office, where he often stayed past midnight. He had need for all this labor, founding, like Washington, a new government, a new nation, except that whereas the earlier patriot had worked in a time of peace, with his war for independence safely won, Davis worked in a flurry against time, with possibly a harder war ahead. Like Washington, too, he lived without ostentation or pomp. His office was upstairs in the ugly red brick state house on a downtown corner, "The President," handwritten across a sheet of foolscap pasted to the door. He made himself accessible to all callers, and even at his busiest he was gracious, much as Jefferson had been. Such aping of the earlier revolutionists was considered by the Confederates not as plagiarism, but simply as a claiming of what was their own, since most of those leaders had been Southern in the first place, especially the ones who set the tone, including 4 of the first 5, 7 of the first 10, and 9 of the first 15 presidents. In adopting a national standard, the present revolutionists' initial thought was to take the old flag with them, and the first name proposed for the new nation was the Southern United States of America. Except for certain elucidations, the lack of which had been at the root of the recent trouble, the Confederate Constitution was a replica of the one its framers had learned by heart and guarded as their most precious heritage. "We, the people of the United States," became We, the people of the Confederate States, each state acting in its sovereign and independent character, and they assembled not to form a more perfect union, but to form a permanent federal government. There was no provision as to the right of secession. The lawmakers explained privately that there was no need for this, such a right being as implicit as the right to revolution, and to have included such a provision would have been to imply its necessity. One important oversight was corrected, however, where the founding fathers, living in a less pious age of reason, had omitted any reference to the deity. The modern preamble invoked the favor and guidance of Almighty God. Nor were more practical considerations neglected. The president and vice president were elected to a 6-year term, neither of them eligible for re-election. Congress was forbidden to pass a protective tariff or to appropriate money for internal improvements. Cabinet officers were to be given seats on the floor of Congress. Each law must deal with only one subject announced in its title, and the president had the right to veto separate items in appropriation bills. Instead of requiring a 3/4 majority, amendments could be ratified by 2/3 of the states. While the newer document expressly prohibited any revival of the slave trade, those chattels referred to in the old one as persons now became outright slaves. And in all territory acquired by the Confederacy, slavery was to be recognized and protected by both the federal and territorial governments. Thus the paperwork foundation had been laid. The Confederacy was a going concern, one of the nations of earth. Whether it would remain so depended in a large part on the events of March and April, following the two inaugurals, particularly as these events affected the sympathies of the 8 states in the 200 to 400-mile-deep neutral region which lay between the two countries. Davis knew this, of course, and knew as well that it would be the opposition's strategy to maneuver him into striking the first blow. This he was willing to do, provided the provocation to strike it was great enough to gain him the approval of the buffer states and the European powers. Actually, the odds were with him, for the neutral states were slave states, bound to the South by ties of history and kinship, and it was to the interests of the nations of Europe to see a growing competitor split in two. Meanwhile, what was needed was patience, which Davis knew was not his dominant virtue, and indeed was hardly a Southern virtue at all. Therefore, though his people were united, as he said, by one purpose of high resolve, he could also speak of his weary heart and troubles and thorns innumerable. Lincoln, up in Washington, had most of these troubles, including the problem of holding the border states, and a greater one as well. Having first made up his mind, he must then unite the North before he could move to divide and conquer the South. He had made up his mind. He had stated his position. "The Union is unbroken," he had said. Yet while Europe applauded the forthright manner in which the Confederacy had set itself in motion, Lincoln was confronted with division even among the states that had stayed loyal. New Jersey was talking secession, so was California, which, along with Oregon, was considering the establishment of a new Pacific nation. So even was New York City, which, beside being Southern in sentiment, would have much to gain from independence. While moderates were advising sadly, "Let the erring sisters depart in peace," extremists were violently in favor of the split. "No union with slaveholders. Away with this foul thing. The Union was not formed by force, nor can it be maintained by force." On the other hand, whatever there was of native Union persuasion was sustained by economic considerations. Without the rod of a strong protective tariff, Eastern manufacturers would lose their Southern markets to the cheaper, largely superior products of England, and this was feared by the workers as well as the owners. The people of the Northwest remained staunchly pro-Union, faced as they were with loss of access to the lower Mississippi, that outlet to the Gulf which they had had for less than 50 years. Then, too, following Lincoln's inaugural address, there was a growing belief that separation would solve no problems, but rather would add others of an international character, with the question of domination intensified. In early April, the New York Times stated the proposition. If the two sections can no longer live together, they can no longer live apart in quiet till it is determined which is master. No two civilizations ever did or can come into contact as the North and South threaten to do, without a trial of strength in which the weaker goes to the wall. We must remain master of the occasion and the dominant power on this continent. Reading this, there were men who faced responsibility. They believed they must accept it as members of a generation on trial. A collision is inevitable, one said. Why ought not we test our government instead of leaving it, meaning the testing, to our children? Walking the midnight corridors of the White House after the day-long din of office-seekers and divided councils, Lincoln knew that his first task was to unite all these discordant elements. And he knew, too, that the most effective way to do this was to await an act of aggression by the South, exerting in the interim just enough pressure to provoke such an action, without exerting enough to justify it. He had good cause to believe that he would not have long to wait. The longer the border states remained neutral, the less they were ashamed of their neutrality in the eyes of their sisters farther south. The Confederates were urged to force the issue. Roger Pryor, a smooth-shaven Virginian with long black hair that brushed his shoulders, a fire-eater irked that his state hung back, was speaking now from a Charleston balcony, advising the South Carolinians how to muster Virginia into their ranks. In less than an hour by Shrewsbury clock, strike a blow. What Pryor had in mind was Fort Sumter out in Charleston Harbor, one of the four federal forts still flying the Union flag in Confederate territory. Lincoln also had it in mind, along with the other three, all Florida forts, Pickens off Pensacola Bay, Taylor at Key West, and Jefferson in the Dry Tortugas. The crowd was delighted with Pryor's advice. So would Lincoln have been if he had heard him, for by now he saw Sumter as the answer to his need for uniting the North. The garrison at Fort Sumter had originally occupied the more vulnerable Fort Moultrie on Sullivan's Island, but the night after Christmas, 6 days after South Carolina seceded, Major Robert Anderson removed his 82 men to the stronger fortress 3 miles out in the harbor. South Carolina protested to Washington, demanding as one nation to another that the troops return to Moultrie. Instead, Buchanan sent an unarmed merchant steamer, the Star of the West, with men and supplies to reinforce the fort. But when the Charleston gunners took her under fire, Union Jack and all, she turned back. That was that. Though they ringed the harbor with guns trained on Sumter and no longer allowed the garrison to buy food at local markets, the Carolinians fired no shot against the fort itself, nor did the Confederate authorities when they took over in March. Buchanan, with his "after me the deluge" policy, left the situation for his successor to handle as he saw fit, including the question of whether to swallow the insult to the flag. On the day after his inauguration, Lincoln received dispatches from Anderson announcing that he had not food enough to last 6 weeks, which meant that Lincoln had something less than that period of time in which to make up his mind whether to send supplies to the fort or let it go. During this period, while Lincoln was making up his mind and seemed lost in indecision, there was played in Washington a drama of cross purposes involving backstairs diplomacy and earnest misrepresentation. Secretary of State William H. Seward, leader of the Republican Party and a man of wide experience in public life, saw the new president as well-meaning but incompetent in such matters, a prairie lawyer fumbling toward disaster, and himself as the administration's one hope to forestall civil war. He believed that if the pegs that held men's nerves screwed tight could somehow be loosened, or at any rate not screwed still tighter, the crisis would pass. The neutral states would remain loyal, and in time even the seceded states would return to the fold, penitent and convinced by consideration. He did not believe that Sumter should be reinforced or resupplied, since this would be exactly the sort of incident likely to increase the tension to the snapping point. In this he was supported by most of his fellow cabinet members, for when Lincoln polled them on the issue, assuming it to be possible to now provision Fort Sumter, under all the circumstances, is it wise to attempt it? They voted 5-2 to abandon the fort. The army, too, had advised against any attempt at reinforcement, estimating that 20,000 troops would be required, a number far beyond its present means. Only the Navy seemed willing to undertake it. Lincoln himself, in spite of his inaugural statement that he would hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, seemed undecided, or anyhow did not announce his decision. Seward believed he would come around in time, especially in the light of the odds among his counselors. Meanwhile, he, Seward, would do what he could to spare the Southerners any additional provocation. Three of them were in Washington now, sent there from Montgomery as commissioners to accomplish the speedy adjustment of all questions growing out of separation, as the respective interests, geographical contiguity, and future welfare of the two nations may render necessary. They had much to offer and much to ask. The Confederate Congress having opened the navigation of the lower Mississippi to the northern states, they expected to secure in return the evacuation of Sumter and the Florida forts, along with much else. Lincoln, however, would not see them. To have done so would have been to give over the constitutional reasoning that what was taking place in Alabama was merely a rebellion by private persons, no more entitled to send representatives to the rightful government than any other band of outlaws. Being also an official person, Seward, of course, could not see them either, no matter how much good he thought would proceed from a face-to-face conciliatory talk. Yet he found a way at least to show them the extent to which he believed the government would go in proving it meant no harm in their direction. On March 15th, the day Lincoln polled his cabinet for its views on Sumter, U.S. Supreme Court Justice John A. Campbell of Alabama, who had not yet gone south, came into Seward's office to urge him to receive the Southerners. The secretary regretfully declined, then added, "If Jefferson Davis had known the state of things here, he would not have sent those commissioners. The evacuation of Sumter is as much as the administration can bear." Justice Campbell was alert at once. Here was Seward, guaranteeing for the government, whose Secretary of State he was, the main concession the commissioners were seeking. To make this even more definite, Campbell remarked that he would write to Davis at once. "And what shall I say to him on the subject of Fort Sumter?" "You may say to him that before that letter reaches him—" "How far is it to Montgomery?" "3 days." "You may say to him that before that letter reaches him, the telegraph will have informed him that Sumter will have been evacuated." Lincoln was still either making up his mind or reinforcing whatever decision he had already made. In this connection, he sent 3 men down to Charleston to observe the situation and report on what they saw. The first 2, both Southern-born, were Illinois law associates. Both reported reconciliation impossible, and one, the faithful Lamon, who had come through Baltimore on the sleeping car with Lincoln, went so far as to assure South Carolina's Governor Pickens that Sumter would be evacuated. The third, a high-ranking naval observer who secured an interview with Anderson at the fort, returned to declare that a relief expedition was feasible. Lincoln ordered him to assemble the necessary ships and to stand by for sailing orders. He would use him or not, depending on events. At the same time, in an interview with a member of the Virginia State Convention, which had voted against leaving the Union but remained in session, prepared to vote the other way if the administration went against the grain of its sense of justice, Lincoln proposed a swap. If the convention would adjourn sine die, he would evacuate Sumter. "A state for a fort is no bad business," he said. Nothing came of this, but at the end of March, when Lincoln again polled the cabinet on the question, the vote was 3-3, one member being absent. Seward by now had begun to see that he might well have gone too far in his guarantees to the Confederate commissioners. When Justice Campbell returned on April 1st to ask why his promise of 2 weeks before had not been carried out, Seward replied with the straight-faced solemnity of a man delivering an April Fool pronouncement. "I am satisfied the government will not undertake to supply Fort Sumter without giving notice to Governor Pickens." "What does this mean?" Campbell asked, taken aback. This was something quite different from the secretary's former assurances. "Does the president design to supply Sumter?" "No, I think not," Seward said. "It is a very irksome thing to him to surrender it. His ears are open to everyone, and they fill his head with schemes for its supply. I do not think he will adopt any of them. There is no design to reinforce it." Campbell reported these developments to the Confederate commissioners, who saw them in a clearer light than Seward himself had done. Restating them in sterner terms, the following day they telegraphed their government in Montgomery, "The war wing presses on the president. He vibrates to that side. Their form of notice to us may be that of a coward who gives it when he strikes." This, or something like this, was what followed. For though Lincoln himself had practiced no deception, at least not toward the Confederates, Seward's well-meant misrepresentations had led exactly to that effect. By now Lincoln was ready. On April 6th he signed an order dispatching the naval expedition to Fort Sumter. Yet Seward was still not quite through. The following day, when Justice Campbell asked him to confirm or deny rumors that such a fleet was about to sail, Seward replied by note, "Faith as to Sumter fully kept. Wait and see." Campbell thought that this applied to the original guarantee, whereas Seward only meant to repeat that there would be no action without warning. And this, too, was taken for deception on the part of the federal government. For on the day after that, April 8th, there appeared before Governor Pickens an envoy who read him the following message. "I am directed by the President of the United States to notify you to expect an attempt will be made to supply Fort Sumter with provisions only, and that if such an attempt be not resisted, no effort to throw in men, arms, or ammunition will be made without further notice or in case of an attack upon the fort." Pickens could only forward the communication to the Confederate authorities at Montgomery. Lincoln had maneuvered them into the position of having either to back down on their threats or else to fire the first shot of the war. What was worse, in the eyes of the world, that first shot would be fired for the immediate purpose of keeping food from hungry men. Davis assembled his cabinet and laid the message before them. Their reactions were varied. Robert Toombs, the fire-eater, was disturbed and said so. "The firing on that fort will inaugurate a civil war greater than any the world has yet seen, and I do not feel competent to advise you." He paced the room, head lowered, hands clasped beneath his coattails. "Mr. President, at this time it is suicide, murder, and you will lose us every friend at the North. You will wantonly strike a hornet's nest which extends from mountains to ocean. Legions now quiet will swarm out and sting us to death. It is unnecessary. It puts us in the wrong. It is fatal." Davis reasoned otherwise and made his decision accordingly. It was not he who had forced the issue, but Lincoln, and this the world would see and know, along with the deception which had been practiced. Through his Secretary of War, he sent the following message to General P.G.T. Beauregard, commanding the defenses at Charleston Harbor. "If you have no doubt as to the authorized character of the agent who communicated to you the intention of the Washington government to supply Fort Sumter by force, you will at once demand its evacuation, and if this is refused, proceed in such manner as you may determine to reduce it." Beauregard sent two men out to Sumter in a rowboat flying a flag of truce. They tendered Major Anderson a note demanding evacuation and stipulating the terms of surrender. "All proper facilities will be afforded for the removal of yourself and command, together with company arms and property, and all private property, to any post in the United States which you may select. The flag which you have upheld so long and with so much fortitude, under the most trying circumstances, may be saluted by you on taking it down." Anderson received it sorrowfully. He was a Kentuckian married to a Georgian, and though he had been the military hero of the North since his exploit in the harbor the night after Christmas, he was torn between his love for the Union and his native state. If Kentucky seceded, he would go to Europe, he said, desiring to become a spectator of the contest and not an actor. Approaching 56, formerly Beauregard's artillery instructor at West Point, he had made the Army his life, so that what he did from a sense of duty. The Confederates knew his thoughts, for they had intercepted his reply to Lincoln's dispatch informing him that Sumter would be relieved. "We shall strive to do our duty," he had written, "though I frankly say that my heart is not in the war, which I see is to be thus commenced." Therefore he read Beauregard's note sorrowfully, and sorrowfully replied that it was a demand with which I regret that my sense of honor and of my obligations to my government prevent my compliance. Having written this, however, he remarked as he handed the note to the two aides, "Gentlemen, if you do not batter us to pieces, we shall be starved out in a few days." Beauregard, hearing this last, telegraphed it immediately to Montgomery. Though he knew that it was only a question of time until the Navy relief expedition would arrive to add the weight of its guns to those of the fort, and in spite of the danger that hot-headed South Carolina gunners might take matters in their own hands, Davis was glad to defer the opening shot. The Secretary of War wired back instructions for Beauregard to get Anderson to state a definite time for the surrender. Otherwise, he repeated, reduce the fort. It was now past midnight, the morning of April 12th. There could be no delay, for advance units of the relief expedition had been sighted off the bar. This time, four men went out in the white-flagged boat, empowered by Beauregard to make the decision without further conferences, according to Anderson's answer. He heard their demand and replied that he would evacuate the fort by noon of the 15th instant, unless he received controlling instructions from my government or additional supplies. This last, of course, with the relief fleet standing just outside the harbor, though Anderson did not know it had arrived, made the guarantee short-lived at best and therefore unacceptable to the aides, who announced that Beauregard would open fire in 1 hour from this time. It was then 3:20 a.m. Anderson, about to test his former gunnery student in a manner neither had foreseen in the West Point classroom, shook the hands of the four men and told them in parting, "If we do not meet again in this world, I hope we may meet in the better one." Without returning to Beauregard's headquarters, they proceeded at once to Cummings Point and gave the order to fire. One of the four was Roger Pryor, the Virginian who had spoken from a Charleston balcony just 2 days ago. "Strike a blow," he had urged the Carolinians. Now, when he was offered the honor of firing the first shot, he shook his head, his long hair swaying. "I could not fire the first gun of the war," he said, his voice as husky with emotion as Anderson's had been back on the wharf at the fort. Another Virginian could and would, white-haired Edmund Ruffin, a farm paper editor and old-line secessionist, 67 years of age. At 4:30 he pulled a lanyard. The first shot of the war drew a red parabola against the sky and burst with a glare, outlining the dark pentagon of Fort Sumter. Friday dawned crimson on the water as the siege got underway. Beauregard's 47 howitzers and mortars began a bombardment which the citizens of Charleston, together with people who had come from miles around by train and buggy, on horseback and afoot to see the show, watched from rooftops as from grandstand seats at a fireworks display, cheering as the gunnery grew less ragged and more accurate, until at last almost every shot was jarring the fort itself. Anderson had 40 guns, but in the casemates, which gave his cannoneers protection from the plunging shells of the encircling batteries, he could man only flat-trajectory weapons firing non-explosive shot. Beauregard's gunners got off more than 4,000 rounds. As they struck the terraplane and rooted into the turf of the parade, their explosions shook the fort as if by earthquakes. Heated shot started fires, endangering the magazine. Presently, the casemates were so filled with smoke that the cannoneers hugged the ground, breathing through wet handkerchiefs. Soon they were down to 6 guns. The issue was never in doubt, Anderson's was no more than a token resistance. Yet he continued firing, if for no other purpose than to prove that the defenders were still there. The flag was shot from its staff. A sergeant nailed it up again. Once, after a lull, which at first was thought to be preparatory to surrender, when the Union gunners resumed firing, the Confederates rose from behind their parapets and cheered them. Thus it continued all through Friday and Friday night and into Saturday. The weary defenders were down to pork and water. Then, at last, the conditions of honor satisfied, Anderson agreed to yield under the terms offered 2 days ago. So far, there had been no casualties on either side. The casualties came later during the arrangement of the particulars of surrender, and finally during the ceremony itself. The first was Roger Pryor, who apparently had recovered from his reluctance and was sent to the fort as one of Beauregard's emissaries. Sitting at a table in the unused hospital while the formal terms were being put to paper, he developed a thirst and poured himself a drink from a bottle which he found at his right hand. When he had tossed it off, he read the label and discovered that it was iodine of potassium. The federal surgeon took him outside, very pale, his long hair hanging sideways, and laid him on the grass to apply the stomach pump that saved his life. A second mishap, this time in the Unionist ranks and far more serious, occurred at 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon. While Anderson, in accordance with the capitulation terms, was firing a 50-gun salute to his flag, an ember fell into some powder. One man was killed in the explosion and 5 were injured. Private Daniel Huff thus became the first fatality of the war before a man had fallen in combat. The scorched and shot-torn flag was lowered and given to Anderson, who packed it among his effects, intending, he said, to have it wrapped about him as a winding sheet on his burying day, then marched his men with flying colors and throbbing drums to the wharf where they boarded a steamer from the relief expedition which had observed rather than shared their fight, but which at least could perform the service of taking them home once it was over. As the weary artillerymen passed silently out of the harbor, Confederate soldiers lining the beaches removed their caps in salute. There was no cheering. Lincoln soon had cause to believe he had judged correctly. Sumter did indeed unite and electrify the North. That Sunday, when the news arrived by telegraph of the surrender in Charleston Harbor, the White House was besieged by callers anxious to assure the president of their loyalty and support. Among them were senators and congressmen who pledged the resources of their states. Their people, they said, would stand by the Union through fire and bloodshed. Among them was Stephen Douglas, who rose from his sickbed, the pallor of death already on his face, to preserve the Union, maintain the government, and defend the Capitol. Thus he reported his pledge to the people afterwards, more than 1 million of whom had voted for him for president, never suspecting that he would be dead by early June. Now, in mid-April, Lincoln met him with outstretched hands and a smile. Douglas was one among many throughout the nation. It was a time for oratory and easy promises. Businessmen formerly opposed to war as economically unsound now switched their line. They wanted it now, as bloody as need be, so long as it was short and vigorous. In Pittsburgh, hangman's nooses dangled from lampposts inscribed, "Death to Traitors." Here, as in other northern cities, secession sympathizers were bayed by angry crowds until they waved Union banners from their windows. Down in Knoxville, Tennessee, the loyal newspaper editor William G. Brownlow declared that he would fight the secession leaders till hell froze over, and then fight them on the ice. That same Sunday, in such a heady atmosphere of elation and indignation, Lincoln assembled his cabinet to frame a proclamation calling on the states for 75,000 militia to serve for 90 days against combinations too powerful to be suppressed by the ordinary course of judicial proceedings. Technically, it was not a declaration of war. Only Congress could declare war, and Congress was not in session. a fact for which Lincoln was duly thankful, not wanting to be hampered. Though he called a special session for July 4th, he expected to have the situation in hand by then. Meanwhile, he proceeded unmolested, having determined in his own mind that extraordinary events called for extraordinary measures. The militia draft was issued the following day, April 15th, to all the states and territories except the rebellious seven, apportioning the number of troops to be forwarded by each. Here, too, at first, the reply was thunderous. The northern states quickly oversubscribed their quotas. Governor after northern governor wired forthright encouragement, asking only to be informed of the administration's needs. Then Lincoln met a check. As he raised a pontifical hand, commanding the persons composing the combinations aforesaid to disperse and retire peacefully to their respective abodes, he was given cause to think that he had perhaps outgeneraled himself. It soon became more or less obvious that just as Davis had united the North by firing on Sumter, so had Lincoln united the South by issuing this demand for troops to be used against her kinsmen. This was true not only in the Cotton States, where whatever remained of Union sentiment now vanished, but also in the states of the all-important buffer region, where Lincoln believed the victory balance hung. Telegram after telegram arrived from governors of the previously neutral states, each one bristling with moral indignation at the enormity of the proclamation, rather as if it had been in fact an invitation to fratricide or incest. Governor Letcher of Virginia replied that since Lincoln had chosen to inaugurate civil war, he would be sent no troops from Old Dominion. "The people of this commonwealth are freemen, not slaves," Governor Rector answered for Arkansas, "and will defend to the last extremity their honor, lives, and property against northern mendacity and usurpation." Governor Ellis of North Carolina declared that his state would be no party to this wicked violation of the laws of the country and this war upon the liberties of a free people. "Tennessee will furnish not a single man for the purpose of coercion," Governor Harris told Lincoln, "but 50,000 if necessary for the defense of our rights and those of our southern brothers." In such hard words did these four governors reply to the call for troops, and their people backed them up. Virginia seceded within 2 days, followed by the other three, Arkansas and Tennessee, and finally North Carolina. East of the Mississippi, the area of the Confederacy was doubled, and her flag, which now could claim 11 stars, flew along a boundary that had leapfrogged northward 200 to 400 miles across soil that had been Union. 4 slave states still dangled in the balance, Delaware and Maryland, Kentucky and Missouri. The first two were cautious. Governor Burton of Delaware reported that his state had no militia and therefore could not comply with the call for troops, while Governor Hicks of Maryland replied that he would forward soldiers only for the defense of Washington. Lincoln was somewhat reassured by their cautiousness, which at least indicated that there would be no precipitate action on their part. He could take no such consolation from the other 2 wires he received. "I say emphatically," Governor McGoffin responded, "Kentucky will furnish no troops for the wicked purpose of subduing her sister southern states." Governor Jackson of Missouri sent the harshest reply of all. "Your requisition is illegal, unconstitutional, revolutionary, inhuman, diabolical, and cannot be complied with." These were frets with which Lincoln would have to deal through the coming months, particularly the problem of holding on to his native state, Kentucky, with its critical location, its rivers and manpower, its horses and bluegrass cattle. "I think to lose Kentucky is nearly the same as to lose the whole game," he said. "Kentucky gone, we cannot hold Missouri, nor, as I think, Maryland. These all against us, and the job on our hands is too large for us. We would as well consent to separation at once, including the surrender of this capital." Maryland compassed the district on 3 sides, while on the 4th, across the Potomac, lay hostile Virginia, whose troops were already on the march, their campfires gleaming on the southern bank. They had seized the arsenal at Harper's Ferry and the Norfolk Navy Yard, and now the Richmond Examiner proclaimed one wild shout of fierce resolve to capture Washington City at all and every human hazard. That filthy cage of unclean birds must and will be purified by fire. It seemed possible, even probable. Many of the Army's best officers were resigning, going south along with hundreds of civil workers from the various departments. The day of the proclamation passed, then another, and still another. Not a volunteer arrived. The city was defenseless. On April 18th, 500 Pennsylvanians showed up, unarmed, untrained. They had met cold stares in Baltimore, but the troops who arrived next day, the 6th Massachusetts, met something worse. A crowd of Southern sympathizers threw bricks and stones and fired into their ranks as they changed trains. They returned the fire, killing 12 citizens and wounding many more, then packed their 4 dead in ice for shipment north and came on into Washington, bearing their 17 wounded on stretchers. 3 days later, when a Baltimore committee called on the president to protest the pollution of Maryland soil, Lincoln replied that he must have troops to defend the Capitol. "Our men are not moles and cannot dig under the earth," he told them. "They are not birds and cannot fly through the air. There is no way but to march across, and that they must do." So the Baltimore delegation went back and clipped the telegraph lines, tore up railroad tracks, and wrecked the bridges. Washington was cut off from the outside world. It was now a deserted city, the public buildings barricaded with sandbags and barrels of flour, howitzers frowning from porticos. The Willards' 1,000 guests had shrunk to 50, its corridors as empty as the avenues outside. Many among the few who remained flaunted secession badges, preparing to welcome their Southern friends. Virginia's Colonel T.J. Jackson had 8,000 men at Harper's Ferry, while Beauregard, the conqueror of Sumter, was reported nearing Alexandria with 15,000 more. If they effected a junction, all Lincoln had to throw in their path was the handful from Pennsylvania and Massachusetts, 5 companies of the former, a regiment of the latter, quartered in the House of Representatives and the Senate chamber. They had arrived on Thursday and Friday. Saturday and Sunday passed, then Monday, and still there was no further sign of the 75,000 Lincoln had called for. "Why don't they come? Why don't they come?" he muttered, pacing his office, peering out through the window. Tuesday brought a little mail, the first in days, and also a few newspapers telling of Northern enthusiasm and the dispatching of troops to Washington, Rhode Islanders and New York's 7th Regiment. Lincoln could scarcely credit these reports, and Wednesday, when officers and men who had been wounded in the Baltimore fracas called at the White House, he thanked them for their presence in the Capitol, then added, "I don't believe there is any North. The 7th Regiment is a myth. Rhode Island is not known in our geography any longer. You are the only Northern realities." Then on Thursday, April 25th, the piercing shriek of a locomotive broke the noonday stillness of the city. The 7th New York arrived, followed by 1,200 Rhode Island militiamen, and an equal number from Massachusetts, whose volunteer mechanics had repaired a crippled engine and relayed the torn-up Annapolis track. A route had been opened to the north. By the end of the month, Washington had 10,000 troops for its defense, with more on the way. Lincoln could breathe easier. An iron hand was laid on Baltimore, securing Maryland to the Union. Major Robert Anderson, the returned hero of Sumter, was promoted to brigadier general and sent to assert the federal claim to his native Kentucky. Major General John C. Fremont, the California Pathfinder and the Republican Party's first presidential candidate, was sent to perform a like function in Missouri. Before long, Lincoln could even assume the offensive. Harper's Ferry was recaptured, Arlington Heights and Alexandria occupied. Confederate campfires no longer gleamed across the Potomac. The fires there now were federal. Fortress Monroe at the tip of the York James Peninsula was reinforced, and an attack was launched against Western Virginia across the Ohio. Within another month, so quickly had despair been overcome and mobilization completed, there began to be heard in the North a cry that would grow familiar. On to Richmond. That city was the southern capital now, moved there from Montgomery toward the end of May at the climax of the fervor following Sumter and the northern call for troops. Vice President Alexander H. Stephens voiced the defiance of the Confederacy, crying, "Lincoln may bring his 75,000 troops against us. We fight for our homes, our fathers and mothers, our wives, brothers, sisters, sons, and daughters. We can call out a million of peoples if need be, and when they are cut down we can call another and still another until the last man of the South finds a bloody grave." Davis, with a sidelong glance at Europe and what history might say, reinforced the defensive character of these words in a message to Congress, called into extra session on April 29th. Though desirous of peace, at any sacrifice save that of honor and independence, he said, the South would meet, not wage, the war now launched by Lincoln. "All we ask is to be let alone," he added. Spoken before the assembly, the words had a defiant ring like those of Stevens. Read off the printed page, however, they sounded somewhat plaintive. When Congress voted to accept Virginia's invitation to transfer the national capital to Richmond, Davis at first opposed the move. In the event of all-out war, which he expected, the strategic risk would be less disconcerting in the Deep South area, where the revolution had had its birth, than on the frontier near the jar of battle. Yet when he was overruled by the politicians who were finding Montgomery uncomfortable and dull, he acceded gracefully, even cheerfully, and made the 2-day train trip without ceremony or a special car. He took instead a seat in the rear coach of a regular train and remained unrecognized by his fellow passengers until he was called to their attention by cheers from station platforms along the way. In Richmond, the Virginians, offering something more of pomp, met him at the station with a carriage drawn by 4 white horses. When a tossed bouquet fell into the street during the ride to the hotel, the president ordered the vehicle stopped, dismounted to pick up the flowers, and handed them to a lady in the carriage before signaling the coachman to drive on. This was noted with approval by the Virginians, already won by the dignified simplicity of his manner, which was tested further at luncheon in the hotel dining room when a group of ladies stood around the table and fanned him while he ate. Davis proved equal even to this, and afterwards at the fairgrounds, having gotten through the ordeal of a handshaking ceremony more exhausting than the 2-day train ride, he made a short informal speech in which he called his listeners the last best hope of liberty. "The country relies upon you," he told them. "Upon you rest the hopes of our people. And I have only to say, my friends, that to the last breath of my life I am wholly your own." Here, as in Montgomery, also a city of 7 hills, our Rome, Virginians called their capital, the people congratulated themselves on having inherited such a president. At St. Paul's, the first Sunday after secession, the words of the first lesson had come with all the force of a prophecy. "I will remove far off from you the northern army, and will drive him into a land barren and desolate, and his stink shall come up, and his ill savor." Now they seemed to have found the man to lead them through its accomplishment. Originally they had had doubts, wondering how a Westerner could head a people so conscious of having furnished the best leaders of the past. But now that they had seen him, they were reassured. Daily he rode out to inspect the training camps, sometimes with his staff, more often with a single aide. Mr. Davis rode a beautiful gray horse, a witness wrote of one of these excursions. "His worst enemy will allow that he is a consummate rider, graceful and easy in the saddle." He devoted most of his energy to organizing an army, work for which his years at West Point and in Mexico, as well as his experience as Pierce's capable Secretary of War, had prepared him well. War was an extension of statecraft, to be resorted to when diplomacy failed its purpose. But Davis took the aphorism one step further, believing that a nation's military policy should logically duplicate its political intentions. Lincoln had more or less maneuvered him into firing the first shot, and while Davis did not regret his action in the case of Sumter, he did not intend to give his opponent another chance to brand him an aggressor in the eyes of history and Europe. "All we ask is to be let alone," he had announced. Therefore, while Lincoln was gathering the resources and manpower of the North in response to the shout, "On to Richmond," Davis chose to meet the challenge by interposing troops where they blocked the more obvious paths of invasion. All this time, men were being forwarded to Richmond by the states. By mid-July, he had three small armies in the Virginia theater. Beauregard, with 23,000 northward beyond the important rail junction at Manassas, facing a Union army of 35,000. Joseph E. Johnston, with 11,000 near the Potomac end of the Shenandoah Valley, facing the 14,000 who had retaken Harper's Ferry. And J.B. Magruder, with about 5,000 down on the York James Peninsula, facing 15,000 at Fortress Monroe, which the North could reinforce by sea. Outnumbered at every point with just under 40,000 opposing well over 60,000 troops, the Confederates yet held the interior lines and could thereby move reinforcements from army to army across any arc of the circle in much less time than the Federals beyond the long perimeter would require. Already there had been clashes of arms. Down the peninsula, at Big Bethel, northwest of Newport News, Major General Benjamin F. Butler attacked one of Magruder's outposts, seven Union regiments against 1,400 Confederates. The attackers became confused, firing into one another's ranks until artillery drove them back. Casualties were 76 for the Federals, 8 for the Confederates, which the latter felt came within a hair of proving their claim that one Southern fighting man was worth 10 Yankee hirelings. Yet there had been reverses, too. Johnston had abandoned Harper's Ferry in mid-June, a strategic withdrawal, he called it, under pressure from superior numbers. But when the Union commander, Major General Robert Patterson, a 69-year-old veteran of the War of 1812, crossed the river in early July, there was a sharp clash at Falling Waters, casualties being about a dozen on each side, not including 50 Northerners taken prisoner. This, too, was felt to be a credit to Southern arms, considering the odds, even though more of Virginia's sacred soil had been yielded to the invader. At the far-off western end of the state, the advantage was clearly with the enemy, but this was blamed on bungling and mismanagement of brave troops. All in all, the Confederates were confident and saw far more reasons for pride than despair in the odds. The victories were glorious, the reverses were explicable. Besides, it was said in discussions on the home front, all this was mere jockeying for position. West Pointism, preliminaries leading up to the one big fight that would end the war and establish Southern independence for all time. The first Confederate Council of War was held July 14th in the parlor of the Spotswood Hotel, where Davis had temporary quarters. Beauregard, as became the popular conqueror of Sumter, sent an aide down from Manassas to propose a plan of Napoleonic simplicity and brilliance. Reinforced by 20,000 men from Johnston, he would fall upon and shatter the Union army to his front. This accomplished, he would send the reinforcements, plus 10,000 of his own men, back to Johnston, who then could crush the smaller army facing him in the valley and march through Maryland against Washington from the north, while Beauregard assailed it from the south. Together they would dictate peace to Lincoln in the White House. This was opposed by Robert E. Lee, the president's military assistant since the consolidation into the National Army of the Virginia forces he had commanded. The handsome Virginian, his dark mustache and hair touched with gray, opposed such an offensive, not only on the obvious grounds that Johnston, already facing long odds in the valley, had in his whole army barely more than half the number of troops Beauregard was asking to have sent eastward, but also on grounds that the Federal Army would retire within its Washington fortifications until it had built up strength enough to sally forth and turn the tables on the Confederates, using Beauregard's own plan against him and Johnston. Davis accepted Lee's judgment, finding that it coincided with his own, and sent the aide back to his chief with instructions to await the Federal advance. It was not long in coming. On the 17th, Beauregard telegraphed that his outposts were under attack. The Northern Army was on the march. Davis promptly wired Johnston, suggesting that he reinforce Beauregard at Manassas by giving Patterson the slip, which Johnston did, arriving by noon of the 20th with the leading elements of his army while the rest were still en route. The first big battle of the war was about to be fought. 3. Christmas Eve of the year before, William Tecumseh Sherman, superintendent of the Louisiana State Military Academy, was having supper in his quarters with the school's professor of Latin and Greek, a Virginian named Boyd, when a servant entered with an Alexandria newspaper that told of the secession of South Carolina. Sherman was an Ohioan, a West Pointer and a former Army officer, 40 years old, red-bearded, tall and thin, with sunken temples and a fidgety manner. He had come south because he liked it, as well as for reasons of health, being 20 pounds underweight and possibly consumptive. The room had a smell of niter paper, which he burned for his asthma. Rapidly, he read the story beneath the black headline announcing the dissolution of the Union,